that distinguishes us from other forms of life. And, you know, on we go. We find our place in our role in society. What stage of development is this? I suppose you could call this adulthood. The sort of thing that our parents are always telling us to achieve, right? I get a youthful chuckle to that. All right, this all sounds really terrific, or sort of terrific, although we have some nostalgia feelings about the freedom of childhood. You get up to this stage of life and you fall in love with a pretty girl and you can carry it through to marriage. In one of Kierkegaard's little writings of this particular stage in his own life, he has a fascinating little thing on criticism of dramatists and novelists, short story writers. He says, what happened? And he says, they can never have a hold on life as it really is. Why? So you have a love story. What happens in a love story? Standard plot. Boy meets girl. Boy and girl fall in love with one another. Boy and girl have falling out. Boy and girl do everything they can to hurt one another. Boy and girl rediscover one another. Boy and girl live happily ever after, right? At the end of Act 3, they're in one another's arms in a passionate embrace, and the music swells, and you just know it's going to be a better world, right? That's aesthetic. Kierkegaard says, that's aesthetic. He says, life has just begun. The good stuff lies ahead, and this is where the plot ends. See? You know, getting married, coming up to the altar this Thursday morning, that's not it. That's the start. Act 1 should begin with that, not Act 3 end with that. Well, this is the ethical person talking to the aesthetic person. The name of the game in America, you know, in our male-oriented society, is not catching yourself a man. The high point in a woman's existence is not wearing the white gown and marching down the aisle. See, but unfortunately, in too many people's view of life, that's the way it is. This is not the epitome. That's the start. I expect maybe the epitome is the 50th wedding anniversary or something like that. Then Kierkegaard says, because the playwrights, and today I suppose you'd say the movie people and the television people, as well as the playwrights and the novelists and the short story writers and so on, because they give us this aesthetic view of life, so many marriages become crashing bores. And of course in those days they didn't divorce as they do now. You know, that's why there are perhaps so many divorces, because we look on getting married as the high point rather than as the starting point. Oh, so the ethical approach to life is the means whereby individuals get integrated into a society. It's the means whereby a society becomes a society. You can't have a society of aesthetes, because you simply have a lot of human beings doing their thing. And you can't get organization, structure, achievement, identity, anything out of this. It is necessary to perpetuate the race. It is necessary for people to become something. Inevitably, what follows from the ethical stage of life is bureaucracy, structuring of existence, creating an organized way of living. An aesthetic kind of way of living is to, you know, plump yourself down wherever you get tired and get your bedroll out. An ethical way of living is to lay out some terrain on a grid and pave it and put sewers in and electrical lines and lots and house here, house here, house here, house here. And of course, the epitome of the ethical is to have every house identical to every other one. Now you can see the ethical is starting not to look so terrific. Okay? Completely rational. The ethical is to have all of life completely organized. To say this morning, thou shalt not rain. See, because nature continues to be aesthetic. And so consequently, we have to organize it. And we do organize it. Now, if we were really operating intelligently here in Molden instead of being to a great extent ecstatical, if we were really intelligent, can you imagine any ethical person doing what Carol's got in mind for us to do starting Wednesday night? Pure aesthetic. if we were being really ethical about this whole business, number one, we would make Holden accessible by automobile, right? How stupid. That'd make it hard to get here. Only an aesthetical person would do that. So first, we build a super highway right to the entrance. So then we roof the whole thing in so that we can control the temperature and everything else. And, one thing after another until we've got a completely controlled environment and maybe we'll run a planned community also, and we'll say, all right, this next week I think we'll have 87 young people and 235 married couples and married persons and so and so many grandparents, and we'll structure our community up. See, this is the rational way of doing things, the planned community. Kierkegaard didn't like this one bit. This was Hegel. This was the way Hegel and Hegel's followers did. You create the system. You make all of existence understandable. It is the sort of thing that causes IBM shares to go up and up and up and up and up and up as we computerize existence and we make everything else fit into the little slot and the little machine, and then it programs us and structures us and organizes us and tells us what to do and how to do it and so on. What happens is that increasingly one's life is determined not by one's own inner impulses, by one's libidinal urgencies, but one's life is determined increasingly by external structures and pressures. And as life gets more complicated, more ethical, you have these little ecstatical rebellions. And you feel like just bursting out. And you feel like you're being crushed and squashed as a person. And you start saying some of the same things that you did when the ecstatical state started to hang out. You say, there must be more to life than 9 to 5, 5 days a week. There must be more to life than the 40-hour week. And by that I don't mean the 35-hour week. Life must make more sense than this. And this is when you're beginning to move beyond the ethical. Now there are a lot of people. There are a lot of people who, when they reach this point, will then become reactionary. They'll try to go back to the good old days of the aesthetic life. But they can't. Because once you have become ethical, you've got only two alternatives. One is to move beyond the ethical, and the other alternative is to become unethical. And to become unethical is to attempt to go back to the aesthetic life. Once you've left the Garden of Eden, you can't go back. Once you have been ethical, you can't be aesthetical again. And so you get into a kind of a never land once again. Let me jump back now. I've taken you through 6 of the 7 points on the ethical, but I haven't taken you to the consequences, but I've been building for it. The consequence which comes for the individual who reaches the end of the line with the ethical, and not everybody does. Many people are very, very happy. Are very, very happy with their little pigeonhole. And they're very, very happy with 9 to 5 and with a completely structured existence and being given orders and coming to work in the morning and then the boss tells them what to do and they do it and then they go home and so on. I mean, most people are happy with the purely ethical life. And as a result, they tend to resist the effort of other people to push them back to the aesthetical or push them forward into what Kierkegaard calls the religious. And this is why we find people who are so strongly ethically conservative, because they feel secure there. And because they feel secure there, they don't want to challenge it, and they don't want it challenged. They don't want anybody upsetting the structure and messing it up, because they got everything figured out, their whole world makes sense, and they're comfortable in it. There are no mysteries. But unfortunately, this is artificial, because life really isn't that way. Ultimately, the meaning that is assumed by the ethical approach to life is that life is completely rational, and that if you only live rationally, everything will work out well. And Kierkegaard points out, the ancient Greeks well knew, although they couldn't get any farther than the ethical, life ultimately is not rational. Life ultimately has something wrong about it. And because there is something ultimately wrong about life, and it doesn't work perfectly, injustice occurs in life. Good people suffer. Bad people get away with things and don't get punished. There's a thing called tragedy. A guy named Socrates is right about everything he says and what happens to him. He's executed for impiety and for corrupting the youth. What is his impiety? He taught that there are not many gods but one God, and that that one God must be good, that that God doesn't have affairs with earthly women and have illegitimate children, that God doesn't get drunk, and all the other things that were true of the gods in the Greek mythology. That's the heresy he taught. Corrupting the youth. What did he teach the young people? He taught the young people that there was such a thing as objective truth, that there was such a thing as goodness, and that finding out what those things were was more important than anything else. And for that he died. So Kierkegaard says, life ultimately is not rational. Life ultimately is absurd. Now, as we get into the religious now, the notion of absurdity is going to take an interesting twist. And I hope I can make it clear for you tomorrow when we get into it. But anyway, life ultimately is absurd. Consequently, the ethical life cannot solve the problem of existence, because it is the imposition of a rational structure on a reality which ultimately is not perfectly rational. It isn't just calculatable and figure-outable and predictable and so on. And so what tends to happen as we see tragedy occur in life, as we see the young die unfulfilled, and the old suffering, and people innocently the victims of wars which they have neither sought nor wanted, and so on, one begins to feel that there must be something beyond the ethical, the purely ethical, to make sense of life. What also tends to happen with the ethical, even when we don't encounter tragedy, is the ethical life has converted life from subjective feelings to objective facts. It is a factual world in which the ethical person lives. Life has been objectified. You look at it and you examine it and you figure it out. People's relationships to one another are on an objective basis. As a matter of fact, what tends to happen in a highly organized ethical society is people deal with one another not as persons, but as functions. And so You are a friend of, not of John Smith, but of the chief of police. And you are the local grocer, and so on. And we are our functions. And we are interacted with functionally rather than personally. We have objective relationships to one another. We formalize our relationships to one another. We formalize our relationship to God. We get together at stated times in stated places. And we formally organize ourselves physically there in relation to one another, you know, on very formal benches that dare not be too aesthetic, right? Because we might be overly comfortable. We have left the aesthetic stage behind. And then we formally do this, and we formally do that. And we do it with, you know, with books that tell us how to do it. See, first you invocate, and then you commiserate. You know, and then you penetrate, and then you orate. We get all organized, right? And then we start feeling confined. See, and the bell just rang, and I've got to quit. See, we're organized. To that extent, holding is organized. And since it is organized for the satisfying of an aesthetic urgency, and a desire for some coffee, blessings, and I'll see you tomorrow. That the explanation of life lies in that little Trinitarian formula. That the way change takes place is if something comes into being, and by virtue of its existence, it ought to just spontaneously generates its opposition, its opposite. And as a result of the tension and interaction and the pressure back and forth from the thesis and the antithesis, something new comes into being which contains within itself both the thesis and the antithesis, and yet it's a reconciliation of the two. So you can see we have thesis number one, and antithesis number two, and a synthesis number three. Right now in Kierkegaard, we've got the aesthetic, and then comes the ethical, and then will come the religious. So we got a three once again. However, unlike Hegel, each one of these stages solves the problem of the previous stage. In other words, you get a synthesis. And so the ethical man who is leading a healthy ethical life is solving his aesthetic problems. See, life is not, well, you've got to give up all hope of pleasure and focus on being good. It's fun being good if life is really good. You enjoy it. You don't sacrifice the aesthetic for the sake of the ethical. Now, in this respect, Kierkegaard is different from Hegel, but he's also different from Immanuel Kant. And this part of Immanuel Kant, Hegel hung on to. And for Kant, the essence of ethics is to do something from duty or to do something on principle contrary to one's natural inclination. In other words, for an action to be an ethical action, you had to frustrate the aesthetic side of your nature, or it didn't count. If it was fun being good, it wasn't worth any brownie points. It had to hurt to be good. And so ethics is kind of an unnatural thing. Well, Hegel continued that thing on, but then argued that there was something beyond that, and you could get a kind of an ethical synthesis. In Kierkegaard, what Kierkegaard is retaining from Hegel is the synthesis, which then generates new kinds of problems, which is also in Hegel. So at any rate, the ethical man who is living ethically, as Kierkegaard would think of him as an ethical person, is achieving aesthetic satisfaction. He's not frustrated. He is not a martyr. He's not an ascetic. He may be having a good time. He can drink all the Danish beer he wants. And you can see this from the notion of marriage, which he used, you know, on the aesthetic level. And the aesthete who cannot marry because marriage is an ethical relationship. Okay, the drive which moves a person toward marriage is an aesthetic drive. It is the erotic, the sexual drive. What happens in marriage? In marriage, you are able to satisfy the sexual drive in an ethically acceptable way. See? In other words, it works. You satisfy the aesthetic need. And you lead a happy marriage. He marriage it happy aesthetically. Now it has another kind of problem, but at any rate, that's one point. And so consequently, when we get up to the religious and the man who is making it religiously, he will also be making it ethically and aesthetically. As a matter of fact, he will satisfy the whole package. So the problems that are ethical problems will not be problems for him. He will be able to handle life. Now there will be people that won't quite be able to get that far and who can't handle life and who can't bring the whole business off. And I particularly emphasize this because there are so many existentialists who see existentialism and the religious as being anti-ethical, anti-establishment. If you're going to be an existentialist, by golly, you got to have your own individual ethic. You know, and nobody else can criticize what you're doing because your ethic is different from everybody else's ethic. Well, that's good old return to the aesthetic level. And it's not the religious at all, as Kierkegaard's talking about it. And you remember the first day I said I was amazed at how conservative Kierkegaard is. The essence of conservatism is to save things, right? And not to lose things. And Kierkegaard is particularly conservative in the sense that when you become ethical, you conserve the aesthetic. You carry it along with you. When you become religious, you carry the aesthetic and the ethical along with you. You solve the ethical problem, the aesthetic problem, you know, and you got the whole thing works. You work within the system. You are successful within the system and so on. Okay, that's kind of a preface. Now, to go back to what we ended with last time, ultimately, the ethical level, the ethical stage is incapable also of being totally satisfying to the seeking human being. Because taking the rational approach to life, the reasonable approach to life, one sooner or later is forced to the realization that reality itself is ultimately not rational. There is a sort of surd in it, so that the principle of justice is not perfectly satisfied, to put it in social and legal terms. There are inequities. The righteous do not experience blessing in life, or at least they can't expect it to happen. This is a kind of a Pollyanna view of life. Life really isn't that way. There are an awful lot of crooks that get ahead. There are an awful lot of crooks that never get discovered as crooks. Living rationally isn't necessarily going to solve life. Well, this doesn't mean that you then live irrationally. But it means that life is not reducible to something that the IBM computer can generate out for you, so that here you are, and you are on the threshold of maturity, and so you go to the government computer, and you feed in your vital statistics, and the computer feeds out your plan for life. And then you follow the plan, and everything goes great. See, you can't do that with life. Life won't cooperate. And so there is a certain surd about it. There is a certain something or other that doesn't quite work about it. With the result that the highest kind of person that is achievable on the rational level is the tragic hero. And the tragic hero is the great person who is highly moral and pious and is destroyed through no one's fault, including his own. You can't explain it. That's the way life is. But that is the ultimate value that is achievable on the rational level. This is the highest value that the Socratic society can think of. That ultimately the nature of reality is such that both gods and men are helpless. And what will be, and there's nothing you can do about it. So ultimately you end up, when you live life rationally, you end up pessimistic about reality and about existence, because this is the highest you can hope for. And so consequently, Kierkegaard mentions three tragic heroes in his leading over into the topic of the religious. Agamemnon. What was tragic about Agamemnon? Agamemnon was the king who led the expedition to Troy to avenge the insult to the Grecian people when his brother Menelaus's wife Helen was snatched off by young Prince Paris from Troy. He gathered all of the Greek armies from the various islands and city-states of Greece. They all gathered at the Gulf of Corinth, which extends from east to, as you look from east to west. And there they were all loaded on their ships, ready to sail across to Troy. And the wind kept blowing and kept blowing and kept blowing and kept blowing from the east. And they couldn't get out. And when they consulted the oracle said, "You must sacrifice that which is most precious to you if the omens are to be favorable for what you are undertaking." All right, now, Agamemnon and his associates, if we look at the situation from an ethical standpoint, they had an ethical obligation to assist Menelaus to get his wife back and to punish the evil. If they don't do anything about it, they're unethical. They are frustrated by nature. Consequently, they must do what is necessary to fulfill their ethical responsibility. Well, what was most precious to Agamemnon was his daughter, Iphigenia. And so he sacrificed his daughter, and the winds changed direction, and they went over, and after 10 years they destroyed Troy and brought Helen back. But he had to sacrifice his daughter. And it was his unfortunate fate to be the head man, the head group, and he was the one who, the head of the group, and he was the one who had to make the sacrifice. Second one, Jephthah. Jephthah, you know, is one of the judges in the Old Testament. Jephthah went out and fought against, I think he fought against the Amorites. And he won a great victory, and he was so elated at the victory. Now, as you were hearing in the last hour, you know, we tend to take credit for things instead of giving God the credit for it. Well, he didn't make that mistake, and he knew good and well why they had won. And in his thankfulness, he said, "Lord, I will sacrifice the first living thing of mine which I encounter when I get back home." And in his thankfulness, he said, "Lord, I will sacrifice the first living thing of mine which I encounter when I get back home." Yeah, and he was sort of a farmer, you know, because it was kind of, Israel was agricultural at the time, and he figured, well, you know, I'll get up to my field and there'll be a cow standing there or a sheep or something like that. Well, he gets almost home, and he's got a little girl who's maybe 3-4 years old and who loves her daddy deeply, and she can hardly wait for daddy to get home, and she runs out there, and she is the first living thing of his that meets him. And he sacrifices her. Tragic heroes. Now this, when we hear these things, you know, we can feel the ultimate extent of rational reality. You know, we feel it in our guts, in our whole being. You know, and there's a kind of a shiver that goes through us. And that's the way life really is, ethically. Well, the third one he mentions is Brutus. A story that's not too well known about Brutus. Everybody knows about Brutus, you know, because he and Cassius organized the assassination of the dictator in order to save the republic. And we all memorized et tu, Brute, you know. But what we don't know about Brutus is that when Brutus was a consul of the Roman Republic, his sons participated in a conspiracy against the government, and it was Brutus's unfortunate responsibility to pass sentence on them, and he condemned them to death. Now, another tragic hero. Well, Kierkegaard mentions these, and then he says, you know, is this all that we can expect from life? Is there no solution? Is there no way of making it safely through life, of successfully carrying out life?
Well, then he thinks of another father and another son. And the father's name is Abraham and the son's name is Isaac. And he tells the story of Abraham and Isaac, and his reflection on the significance of Abraham-Isaac's story is the content of the book Fear and Trembling. You remember in the book of Hebrews, Abraham is mentioned as the great example of faith in the Old Testament. Well, God came to Abraham one day and he said, Abraham, as a token of your love for me, I want you to sacrifice your son Isaac, remember. Now, Isaac was, from an aesthetic standpoint, Isaac was the love of aged Abraham's life, because you remember Abraham was 100 years old and he and his wife had long since almost given up hope for a child. And so, you know, he's the child of an aged couple. And that's, you know, they're old enough to be his great-grandparents, to say nothing about his grandparents. So he was very, very special. And he's the only child of Abraham and Sarah. And so he, from an aesthetic standpoint, you know, this is Abraham's most precious possession. And so it's a terrible aesthetic demand on him to ask him to give up his son. From an ethical standpoint, God is asking Abraham to commit murder. See, murder is not right. There's no suspension of ethical rules. Murder is not right. What is even more profound in the situation is God had given Abraham the promise of salvation. And the promise was in him and his seed. And nations of the world would rejoice because of him and his seed. But here he is asked to cut off his seed, to kill his son. And what God is saying to him is, destroy your hope of salvation. Damn yourself. Which is the most profound thing in the whole situation. And so Abraham heads off for the mountain, a few days' journey away with his son Isaac, and he climbs to the top of the mountain and he lays his son out there and he prepares to kill him. Well, if there was no more to life than the ethical, what would have happened? Abraham would have killed Isaac. We would all be damned. Folden Village, I'm sure, wouldn't exist because there would be nothing to rejoice about. And, you know, who would want to be concerned about the spiritual, because we would simply comfort one another in our impending damnation? If there were no more to life than that, than the ethical, life would not be worth living. The fact that Abraham lived, and the fact that Abraham did not kill Isaac, and the fact that it was possible for Abraham to fulfill the will of God in this situation and satisfy the aesthetic and satisfy the ethical and satisfy the religious demand of God shows that there is more to life than the ethical, and that one can go beyond the ethical, and that the solution to existence lies in something which is beyond the ethical. And anyone who tries to solve the problems of life by being ethical is simply going to frustrate himself, and one has to go beyond the ethical to what Kierkegaard calls the religious. And it's very difficult to describe. Why? Because I'm dealing with you right now on the ethical level, on the rational level. I'm explaining things to you, see? I'm not dealing with you on the religious level. If we were doing it on the religious level, I suppose we'd have a kind of an ecstatic experience together. And I can't talk about God very well, because God can be dealt with as he is only in the second person, you know, as you. And I can't talk about him. See? And this is why whenever Kierkegaard gets up to the religious level in his writings, it will either be a prayer where he talks to God personally, or it will be a reflection, a meditation on the religious, where he reflects on his experience with God. That's the only way you can handle it. You know, so if I were going to do the religious at this point, I suppose I would either begin praying or I would sit here and just sort of talk to myself and ignore you, and you'd kind of listen in. See? Well, I'm not going to do it that way, because we're doing the didactic approach, and that's ethical. And so I'll continue talking to y'all. But at any rate, you can understand why it won't work to complete satisfaction. Okay. So, the religious is possible. Now, how is it possible? The way that Kierkegaard likes to put it is, how can timeless God have anything to do with man in time? Or a world of time? You know, how can there be any kind of relationship back and forth there? Because there has to be for the religious to be possible. Otherwise, we're stuck with the ethical. Well, let me give you a couple of clues to it. Number one, on the aesthetic level, where does the psyche go for its goal, for its values, its meanings, and so on? It goes to itself. It turns in on itself, and it consults its desires. You know, its feelings, desire for pleasure, desire to escape pain, and so on. So it is self-directed, self-centered, self-motivated. When it becomes ethical, it becomes other-directed, and it reaches outside itself, both for answers to the questions of what it is to do, but also for questions, answers to questions like, who am I? So the first time, it turns into itself. The second time, it turns out from itself. Now, what do you suppose we're going to do here? It's going to be very Hegelian. And we're going to preserve the first one, and we're going to preserve the second one. So which direction is the psyche going to go?
Outside.
No, you only got two alternatives, outside and inside.
Inside.
It will go inside, and what will it encounter? Someone other than itself. God. So it will find God within itself. Now, we'll find God within itself because God has put himself there. And God has put himself there through the Spirit working through the Word. But the individual will find God, you know, not as the Russian cosmonauts try to, by zipping around out in space and coming back and saying, we didn't find God out there. Ha, ha, ha. You said, did you think you would? You don't find God out there. As a matter of fact, you don't find God at all. He finds you. And all of a sudden, you discover him in you. So your source of motivation and meaning comes from within you for your action. But it's not you, as on the aesthetic level. Okay. Little jump back to Socrates. How does one... Now, this is the basis for the action possibility. What about the knowledge situation? From a knowledge standpoint, there's a very famous dialogue by Plato called The Sophist. And it is concerned with the question of, we were kicking around in a kind of frustrated way last night, what is education? And who is the teacher? And it's called The Sophist because at that time the Sophists, who were teachers of persuasion and speech, who ran schools and charged a lot of money to teach people, purported to be the educators, and Socrates was concerned to demonstrate that they didn't educate and how education would take place. Well, Socrates was an educator, but he described himself as a midwife. Then he said, learning takes place within the individual. As the individual becomes pregnant with an idea and develops the term and gives birth to it. And the function of the teacher is to be the midwife that assists him in having a successful delivery. And the human teacher can do no better than that. But where does the idea come from? Well, the idea comes from God. And so God is the real teacher. God is the one who produces the content for the individual and who puts it within him. And the human educator simply serves as a kind of helper or stimulator to enable the individual to bring the knowledge forth from within himself. How does knowledge happen? Now, in this respect, Kierkegaard is very Platonic in his theory of knowledge. How does knowledge happen? Knowledge does not happen, you know, in a kind of an organized, systematic, structured kind of way, you know, where you work out your lesson plan intelligently in a good, ethical, structured kind of way, and then you carry it out the way you planned it, and lo and behold, all of the kiddies learned it today. And then tomorrow, you work out the next lesson. You know, and he said, it doesn't work that way at all. It comes in moments of insight, in moments when an idea bursts forth within us, rises up within us, and the outside can kind of stimulate it, or the environment may be kind of conducive for education to occur. And under certain kind of circumstances, more people come to know something than other kind of circumstances, but that's about the best that we can do. And it works through God and the Holy Spirit. And when he talks this kind of language, he's going back to Augustine, who taught that the Holy Spirit is the source of all knowledge, including the knowledge that pagans have, because he is the Spirit of truth, and he reveals truth to the mind of men, and it wells up within them, and it is not found and gathered from outside them. So once again, you have a theory of knowledge which goes beyond the ethical, and most of our theories of knowledge are what Kierkegaard would call ethical theories of knowledge. Okay, so it works this way. How is this possible? You know, all of this sounds very absurd, right? Sounds kind of absurd. It's not the way we ordinarily think. It's absurd, right? Well, if you know a little bit of Latin, you know that the word a or ab is a preposition which means by means of. And so Kierkegaard takes this word absurd quite literally and says, God is able to do it by means of the absurd. Because life is not perfectly rational, structured, completely knowable, and so on, God is able to do things. God is able to rise up within and take over our heart. God is able to change us in a moment. God is able to convert us so that we undergo a complete personality change sometimes. God can change us from this to that. By virtue of the absurd, by virtue of the fact that life is more than rational. And so it is on this level that one can successfully live. And so he says, one man can fall in love with a young lady and become engaged to her and realize that he must give her up and spend the rest of his life in lonely bachelorhood. That's Kierkegaard. Another man may have the same experience, and he gets married and lives happily ever after. He can pull it off. The first guy couldn't. One man may, you know, strike out in life, and he has one reverse after another. He does everything intelligently. He leads a highly moral life, and he fails. Another man just seems to float through life, and everything works out fine. He uses the example of dancing. Imagine a Danish dance floor. Now, there are all kinds of people going out to dance, and the music is going on. And there's one guy out there, and he's just kind of whipping around, doing his own thing, and you know, he whips around and he tries to avoid everybody. You know, that's the aesthetic. Well, the orchestra is playing a waltz. And here's another guy, and he's got his Arthur Murray foot there, and he's going, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. He's the ethical guy, and he's going according to the pattern, you know, and so on. And then there's another guy here, and he hasn't got the Arthur Murray footsteps or anything like that, and he's just loafing around, you know, and all the girls are wishing that he's going to invite them to dance because he is just a perfect dancer. Just great. And he never learned it. It's just spontaneous. He's a perfect waltz. And then there's another guy here, and he knows the Arthur Murray steps. He doesn't have to walk around and watch his feet and so on. But he never gets beyond 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. But he knows there's more than 1, 2, 3 to waltz. But now these are the different kind of people you have.
And when you get to the end of the ethical and you realize that there's more than the ethical to life, you get three kinds of people. Number one, you get that guy with the Arthur Murray footsteps and who is saying that the religious life is to be ethical, and who will reduce religion to a series of procedures, true propositions which must be believed or else, you know, and a kind of structured, figured out existence. Kierkegaard called him the Philistine. Then there's another man who realizes that there must be a life beyond the ethical, and he wants it, and he tries it, and he falls flat on his face. And so he has to settle for being ethical, even though he knows there's something beyond that, and he calls him the Knight of Infinite Resignation. He wants to move with infinite steps. He wants to rise above the finitude of his rut in which he is, but he can't pull it off. He knows that there could be more to life than he's capable of living, but he also knows that he can't be anything more than what he is, and so he has to resign himself to what he is. And Kierkegaard thought he was one of those kind of people. And then finally we have the Knight of Faith, who can just put it all together and do it. And he succeeds on the aesthetic level, he succeeds on the ethical level, and he succeeds on the religious level. He does it right. And you can see that he does it right. See, now he's not an anti-establishment guy or anything like that. Kierkegaard's ideal. This is a guy who puts it all together and it all works right. Right? Who is this terrific guy? What does he look like? Kierkegaard says if you encounter him on the street or he's pointed out to you and you look at him, your response is, gee, he looks like a shopkeeper. He's Mr. Ordinary. You know, he's not a great saint or something like that. He's an ordinary guy. Likely, he's not even a clergyman. That's what the Knight of Faith is like. It just works. He is carried by God. He is conscious of the fact that everything that he does, God is conscious of, God is aware of, and that it has eternal significance for him. Because what he does is done to the glory of God. And if it's done wrong, you know, it's not to the glory of God. And so every move that he makes, Kierkegaard says, aware of eternity. Yeah, but not scared stiff, afraid to move. This is what tends to happen with the Knight of Infinite Resignation. See, Kierkegaard, Knight of Infinite Resignation, he comes up to the idea of marriage. See, and I look around and see whether a potential bridegroom is here so that we don't scare him out since tomorrow morning today. Okay, he's here before. Okay, he comes up to marriage, and all of a sudden, he is aware of the fact that for the rest of his life, he is committing himself to that woman. And he doesn't know what the rest of his life is going to be like. I don't know whether I want to do that. See, so he chickens out and remains a bachelor. I just can't enter into that personal a relationship with another human being. And so I have to, you know, I just have to pull back from that. He completes his university training for a theological diploma and authorization to become a clergyman. And to become a clergyman means that you speak as the oracle of God to people, and people believe that what you are saying is God's word. And people tend to be very credible of their pastor, particularly if they love him and trust him. And he can almost tell them almost anything and they will believe it. So it's a terrible responsibility to be a pastor. And one handles
the body and blood of the Lord in the sacrament of the altar. You know, in the sacrament of baptism, you bring the power of the Holy Spirit onto a living human being. You know, you're not playing games when you're handling the sacraments. You're handling the most powerful things we have in the world. Luther was, you know, Luther was scared about it when he celebrated his first Mass. He was so petrified that he about fainted when he consecrated the elements. And he had a little trouble with his underpants also. And they practically had to drag him out to the altar and drag him back. He was so scared of being a priest because he was so in awe of God. Well, Kierkegaard had this same kind of feeling. And this is why he could never become a clergyman. And at the same time, there was his friend Pastor Bazin that I told you about the other day. You know, who was an ordinary klutz? But he was able to be a clergyman. And he tended to be more ethical and religious. You know, he was very, very concerned about the rules of the established church. But still in all, he was able to do it, and Kierkegaard wasn't. And so there are a lot of knights of infinite resignation that they can't quite pull it off, and yet they know what it's like to do that, or to be that way. And so, now this is the panoply of the whole business. How is it possible for the religious to occur? I suppose I can end with that one. How is it possible for the religious to occur? Well, Kierkegaard says there are only two alternatives that God has. The one alternative is to raise man up to the level of God, which is what man thought he was going to get when he tried the fruit in the garden. You know, you will be like God. That direction doesn't go, and so consequently God has to come down to man. What is the most absurd thing that God could do? Well, the most absurd thing that God could do would be to come down and to die. Is there anything more absurd than that, for God to die? Okay. And so we think of absurd in one sense, you know, it's ridiculous, stupid. And yet, at the same time, when we take that absurdo by means of the absurd, this is exactly the way God operates. By means of the surd, by means of the fissure in the perfect structure of reality, God is able to enter in and shift. Every action which is performed is less than perfect because of the action of Satan, and so it is not good, but at the same time it is by virtue of its imperfection that God is able to enter in and do something to it and change it. If it were perfect, it would be unchangeable. And so consequently, it is only by virtue of the universe being assured that God can do something to it, and that we can lead life successfully. And so you end up with an interesting paradox at the end, and what is most paradoxical about it is that it makes complete sense, and if it didn't, I couldn't explain it to you. See, so it is something which is not nonsense or against sense, but it is something which goes beyond the rational, and yet it is consistent with the rational. And so the religious thing is consistent with the ethical and with the aesthetic. And, you know, this is what one must aim at. And I mentioned to you on the first day that I just don't see in Kierkegaard's thought how it is possible for anyone other than a Christian to reach that. Because what is essential for one to achieve that point is for God to be active in one's heart. And this is possible only if one is a Christian. Okay, how are we doing on time? Oh, we have got a few minutes if somebody wants to ask something or say something.
I'm impressed how similar this is to the Jungian view, where he talks about the reconciliation of opposites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Very similar.
Mm-hmm. Jung is another one who reacted against, you know, the Hegelian dialectic. And who said that It is reconciliation that is the essence of the way reality works, not antagonism.
Mm-hmm. Sir?
Yes.
He's often wondered if kindergarten had gotten married like he should have.
There's an ethical remark.
What brought him down to earth and brought him out of his theoretical idealism into some practical reality. Have you ever speculated on that?
Well, what you're saying is if Kierkegaard had gotten married, he would have concluded that there was nothing beyond the ethical.
No, I don't know if I'm saying that. I didn't intend to say that.
But that's the implication of what you're suggesting.
Sir?
Yes.
I've often wondered if Kierkegaard had gotten married like he should have.
There's an ethical remark.
Brought him down to earth and brought him out of his theoretical idealism into some practical reality. Have you ever speculated on that?
Well, what you're saying is if Kierkegaard had gotten married, he would have concluded that there was nothing beyond the ethical.
No, I don't know if I'm saying that. I didn't intend to say that.
But that's the implication of what you're suggesting. You see, what Kierkegaard is saying, finally, is that the religious is very practical. As a matter of fact, it's most practical because it works. And everything else, every other level has bugs and frustrations in it, and it is only the religious level that does work. But it does not work by means of something you can do. In other words, you can't teach people how to be religious. And you can't put up, construct a system of how to achieve the religious stage or something of that sort. Because when we get to that point, this is where we get divine intervention. And without divine intervention, there's nothing we can do. The best we can do is the ethical level. Now, I think there are some aspects of Kierkegaard's personal life which I think would have been probably considerably improved by marriage. I suspect his marriage with Cordelia might not have been too successful. But with a proper wife, he certainly would not have had exhibited all the eccentricities which he had in his later life. Now, as he got toward the latter part of his life, he began to get obsessed with the idea of personal suffering. And so he began to get pathological. Now, this is my view of Kierkegaard, and not everybody agrees with me. But I think in the last 5 or 6 years of his life, he became pathological. And he began to turn his doctrine inside out. And he came to the conclusion that to be a Christian is to suffer. Now, his doctrine, his earlier doctrine was to be a Christian is to make it. In other words, the Christian who is in every respect a Christian will be successful in life. Granted that many Christians will be knights of infinite resignation and won't get that far. But under Christianity alone is solving the problem of existence possible. Then he began to get attacked by all sorts of people. And he began to come to the conclusion that to be a Christian is to suffer and to be misunderstood. But then he went back to the Socratic model, and Socrates was attacked by people, and finally executed with general approval in the Athenian state. And he took the various passages in the latter parts of the Gospels where Jesus tells his disciples, men will hate you for my name, and so on. And so he said, to be a Christian is to suffer. If you are not suffering, then what? Then you are not a Christian. Therefore, you got to go out and do something that will cause people to cause you to suffer. So he just plain got obnoxious. See, because he felt the need to suffer. And so he got so that he rejected any kind of human efforts to communicate with him positively. If somebody tried to be a friend to him, slap their hand. Rejected him because he began to take sort of the hermit's direction for life, and a kind of direction which he himself 10 years earlier had rejected as an attempt to ethicize the religious. You create the monastic movement, you know, with the living in the monastery and the steps of things that you do and your stages to holiness. This is ethicizing religion. The idea is that if you do it right and you do it long enough, sooner or later, all of a sudden the heavens will open and you will see God. You will have the beatific visions. Well, this is reducing religion to a system. And it was an effort to try to create the religious system and to make it available for human beings. And he rejected this as a halfway measure and as wrong. But at the end of his life, he was sort of doing the same thing. And he did get rather irrational in his behavior, as well as eccentric.
Well, I've often wondered if either he could have gotten married or have gotten into the priesthood.
Yeah.
He could have been tempered in his extremes and mellowed a little bit, having to deal with reality instead of theory. Mm-hmm. Having to deal with simple people all the time.
Yeah. He would have gotten away from so much introversion. Yeah. At the same time, you know, you could say something like that about Freud, and you say, well, you know, Freud would have been one heck of a lot better psychologist if he didn't hang around with mentally ill people so much. And some people have said that, you know, that the trouble with Freudian psychology is that it's based on his study of insane people. Now, if he'd studied normal people, he might have come out with something different. So, I suppose that the final evaluation of somebody like Kierkegaard is really, does he help me to understand myself and the world, or doesn't he? And that's what a man rises and falls. And now what he would have thought, or what he would have been, or what he would have said if he had gotten married and become a Danish Lutheran clergyman in some small town outside Copenhagen. You know, it's who's to say what he would have done or been.
But if he helps you, only through your middle age, and not enough to carry you through old age, to find yourself in the predicament that he was in his old age, it's not helping you very much.
No, but the predicament he was in his old age, and he wasn't really that old, I mean, he was sort of early middle age, but the predicament that he ended up in is not consistent with his psychological doctrine. In other words, it is his behavior, he began to act contrary to his own principles. So he contradicted his own principles, and from that point on, he ceased to be consistent.
His end was very much conditioned by his particular life, what he had witnessed in his particular father.
And I think also it's always fun to read literature that's critical of establishment and see all the names and images that are used and so on. But his last critical works of the Danish state church almost reached the point of absurdity. And he was, you know, as a creative mind, he was rapidly going downhill. He had produced what he, you know, what was useful, and in the last few years, he'd become a propagandist rather than a creative thinker. So his best work is in his early and middle works, and not so much in his last works. Although it always does the church good to be criticized. Keeps it loose, keeps it from getting ossified.
It seemed like he couldn't deal with what Paul is talking about, the sin inside of himself. He never found a way, or God didn't reveal to him a way to deal with the old self. And so he just kind of resigned himself to it. There was no power to conquer, which was his model. Mm-hmm. The Christian that overcomes the evil or overcomes the problems.
Yeah, in the final analysis, when you get You know, every time I've talked about Kierkegaard, I get about the same kind of reaction at this point, you know, because it, gee, it really was terrific for the first stage and the second stage, and boy, all of a sudden, here is going to be the answer to life that I've been looking for, you know, and now I'm going to go home from Holland Village and apply it, and we, you know, and it's clear sailing from here on in. You know, all of a sudden it's not anything you can do, and it's up to God. You know, and you sort of stop and then you think about it a little bit and you say, by golly, I'm trying to operate this thing out of the ethical level, you know, where I'm in charge. Yes, you are nowhere ever more in charge than on the ethical level.
Right. The key word, I think, is relinquishment at that point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is what Kierkegaard makes a great deal of, and you struggle. Mm-hmm. And he lists a whole number of stages where you struggle to hang on to the ethical, to hang on to, I'm running my life. Yeah. And you try to twist things to fit your values. You try to twist scripture to fit what you want it to mean. And you interpret it in a certain way and you try it and it doesn't work. And then you say, well, heck with the whole business. And that doesn't work. And then you come back and say, Jim, sorry, God, I did it. And then finally, you just give up. And that's when it starts working. Or you find out that you're not going to, you know, you will have to settle for the best you can come up with.
My problems are very much in that same area, the introversion and the singleness. What would Kierkegaard do with his baptism? Or couldn't he appropriate that gift? It seems to me that the difference between Kierkegaard and Luther is that when Luther reached those points of extreme insecurity and inwardness, he had his baptism.
Yeah.
And that I don't find in Kierkegaard. I shouldn't say I don't find. I haven't heard it.
Yeah. But before I respond to that, may I point out to you that from this point on, you are faced with the ethical choice of listening or drinking. So you don't have to remain. The coffee hour has begun. Okay, Jerry. I think there is a certain element of that. Now bear in mind that what Kierkegaard is doing in all of his writings is writing egocentrically. He is writing from the ego out reflectively. And so consequently, he will be going at the whole business from a personal human standpoint. See, whereas Luther tends to write third-person objective about the human being and also about God. And so he approaches it from a different standpoint. Now, when you operate...
But Luther could say, I am baptized, and that's first person, and it's talking about an identity.
Yeah, but now where does he get his security? You know, whether you're talking about baptism or you're talking about the Lord's Supper and you get around to that section in his catechism, where does the security come from? It's not the water that does it. It's not the bread that does it. It's not the wine that does it. It is the Word.
See?
And so he is Word-centered. See, and the Word is outside of him, and he is interacting with it and dealing with it cognitively and non-cognitively, but strongly cognitively. And he has the sure Word of God. He also concerns himself a great deal with, you know, why didn't we just get Scripture? Why did we get baptism? Why did we, in particular, why did we get the Lord's Supper? Well, you know, we human beings are so weak. He has a much better understanding of the common man than Kierkegaard does. Maybe that's what you were leading to. Luther has a much better understanding of the common man and his needs. Kierkegaard is an intellectual. And so Luther says, well, you know, God understood us. And, you know, us German peasants, we got to have something we can feel to trust in. So there's that bread we can taste, and there's that wine that we can taste, you know, and as sure as we can taste that, by golly, that surely God loves us and has forgiven us. See, and he tends to emphasize, the weakness of our nature and our dependency on God because we are so weak. And it's a personal relationship, whereas Kierkegaard is much more philosophical and concerned with what does it mean? How can you cope with it? And to is there some way one can make sense out of existence? Or what levels of reality are there? And so there are agreements and disagreements between them. And ultimately, when you get to the points, because you're dealing philosophically with things, it means you're dealing rationally with things. Ultimately, when you get to the points where the payoff is supposed to come, you get a non-rational answer, which is frustrating.
Does he ever deal with the sacraments?
I don't think so. Only indirectly. They aren't really important. What he's most concerned about is that aspect of life where of interaction with God, internal.
Yeah. His three steps also point to where it seems like a lot of people are now, where they've gone past the rational, that they've gotten into the mystic thing or the drug experience. Or
right, that's right.
Man is mystic now.
Yeah, that's right.
Would you say that's kind of stuck in between, or is that going back to the ascetic again?
In some cases it would be going back to the ascetic.
Yeah.
In some cases it would be a kind of perversion where you attempt an escape from reality, a kind of unconsciousness of reality, or the LSD business very well could be an attempt to achieve a heightened reality in order to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite true. There have been lack of satisfaction with the ethical and attempt to get beyond the ethical. And Kierkegaard would say, there is no way that you by yourself are going to get there.
I think also, though, in that interest, more than interest, a kind of reaching into the mystical or being open to that kind of thing is also an attempt to get out of oneself. The thing about Kierkegaard that really puts me off is that tremendously deep drive inward.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's strongly introverted, and you dredge up all reality from your
within.
Guts.
Mm-hmm. And to me that's a reflection of one of the places where our culture is sickest. And that we tend to emphasize a mode of life that's very individual, very individualistic, focuses more and more on interior feelings or experiences. I see that as a part of our divorce from the natural world, from the created world of which we are a part. Mm-hmm.